Vansa Kalpa 2 verse 10. ಕೃಪಸಿಂಧು ವೈಶ ಪತಿತ್ರಂಭೋ ವೈಷ್ಣವೋ. Now we shall begin hearing Brahma's prayers, because Brahma has seen something extraordinary. He's seen Krishna, the little cowherd boy. He had seen Krishna's reaction. Krishna, the little cowherd boy who was wandering in the fields of Vrindavan, searching for the calves, and in one hand he was holding, in left hand he was holding a mixture of yogurt and fruit. Just a little boy. As if just a little boy. Actually, he was a little boy, but he wasn't only a little boy. He was the all-powerful Supreme Lord. So Brahma wanted to find out something about Krishna's powers. So he tested him with his own powers, which were great within the universe. He tested Krishna by taking away the calves, wanting to see if Krishna would become bewildered by his own powers, or Krishna would immediately understand that Brahma had taken them away and say, "Brahma, please come and give back my calves." Or he wanted to see if Krishna would do something wonderful. He didn't know how Krishna would react to the display of his powers. So when he took away the boys, he went away. He took away the calves first and then the boys, and then he went away and he saw that Krishna was looking for the calves. And then when he returned, which was a year in the earth time, but a moment in his own time, he saw the calves and the boys exactly as they were before. They were playing with Krishna. And he was bewildered because he had thought he had taken the boys and the calves, and then he looked and he saw that the same boys and calves were there. So he couldn't understand if the boys and the calves here were the real ones, or the boys and the calves there were the real ones, or they were both real ones, or they were both false ones, or they were moving back and forth. He couldn't understand. And he became bewildered. And then, just to give him a little more medicine, Krishna showed him who exactly those calves and boys were. They were his expansions. And suddenly, as Brahma was bewildered, his bewilderment increased an infinite amount when he saw these boys and calves turn into forum forms, Vishnu forms. And he knew that Lord Narayan was his worshipable deity. So there were countless boys and countless calves, asankhya. And suddenly there were countless Vishnu forms in front of him. And each of those Vishnu forms had come from Krishna. And there were countless numbers of them. And each of them was being worshipped by all the living entities of the universe. And each of them were infinitely powerful. So if a sun, meaning the bright globe in the sky, could produce countless other suns, countless suns coming from that sun, and each one of those suns was giving off the same amount of energy as that original sun, and the sun hadn't lost any of its power, something like that. So Krishna had expanded himself, and Brahma could see these forms had come from Krishna, who was still standing there as a little coward boy, And he was a little coward boy, but he wasn't only a little coward boy, because he had expanded into all these different unlimited forms that each had unlimited power. And Brahma was completely stunned, because he had encountered the meaning of the Absolute Truth. He had assumed the limitations of Krishna due to his own limitations, practically speaking, because we see really according to our own minds. Atmavan manyate jagat. We don't exactly see reality as it is, but we see according to the conceptions of our own mind, and an ant and a termite and a bee and a bird and a lion, and throughout different classes of human beings and birds, everyone just sees according to the concepts that fill one's own mind. And we are limited by that. But Brahma had contact the unlimited. And he had contact the unlimited, and the unlimited did not fit within his mind at all. And he fainted. And then when he got up, Krishna withdrew the forms, in the sense of he could no longer see Vishnu. He just saw the cowherd boys and the calves. He actually just saw Krishna, and he saw himself in Vrindavan, and he was astounded, because he understood that that little boy was unlimited. And he understood that the activities that he was performing in Vrindavan, as well as the place Vrindavan, none of them had anything to do with the concepts by which he was viewing them. They were all extraordinary. They were all unlimited. They were all beyond his comprehension. So the most intelligent is going to glorify the unlimited supreme absolute truth to the best of his ability. And he's going to find out that his ability, great as it is his ability was his ability was quite conceivable, but his ability was insignificant compared to the inconceivable. But yet he's going to do it, because what else could he wanted all the prayers. He wanted to glorify, but he didn't think his prayers were wonderful, but rather with his little vision, thinking of himself like an insect at the foot of the Himalayan mountains, he was going to try and describe these mountains. And he is the most intelligent. So and this point will come up very, very soon, perhaps in the third verse, when a limited person of this world is arrogant and thinks he is going to understand the absolute truth by virtue of his own intelligence, it's actually most foolish. If he understood, if he had even an inkling of the understanding, small conception, even just a glimpse of what it means to be all powerful, and that is Krishna. So the first verse, if would have been nice in one sense to project the verses, but I want to go through them a little quickly because we don't have much time. So I'll read some Sanskrit and some English, and you'll just kindly listen. The first thing Brahma says is Namidyate Abra Vabushe Tadit Ambraya. Namidyate Namaste, Nama. He's offering his obeisances. The first thing he does is offer obeisances. What does it mean when one offers obeisances? What does it mean to you? Of course, we offer obeisances very regularly, so it doesn't mean anything to us. A little bit of exercise, perhaps. Or this is what you do when you come in. But what does it mean? It means I'm bowing down to this, in this case, this little boy. And here's Brahma, who has the upadhi, or the overlay on his consciousness of being the supreme controller of the universe. So this, no matter if you're the supreme controller of the universe or the controller of your bicycle, it's still very hard to actually bow down, because it's counter to the false ego. The false ego, soon as we Krishna bhule se jeev, soon as we turn our back on Krishna, we are covered by a false sense of who we are. We turn our back on our relationship with Krishna, and then because we exist and we are someone, and we're not, when we turn our back on Krishna's service, we're not who we actually are, so we have to adopt a false sense of self. And there are unlimited, countless false identities available, but they all have in common that they're false identities, and they all are thinking themselves as central, and it's illusion. So everyone is enamored by everyone with a false ego is enamored by a false sense of who we are, and that false sense is of greatness and sensualness, but it's false. It's false. So the first acknowledgement of it's false, and for people who are essentially innocent, it's not that hard to do, is an obeisance or a bowing down. And in all religious traditions, in one form or another, this is part of worship, a bowing down. In the Jewish tradition, they...
Just a little.
Well, it's hard on the knees, it's hard on the ankles, okay. But it's something. And in the Catholic Church, they bow down on one knee. I mean, two is asking a lot. But it's the same concept, although, you know, you can see how it's been lightened over the ages, but it's lightened in the sense of, okay, you don't really want to bow down fully, okay, but at least make some gesture towards it, some movement towards submitting. In Islam, they bow down and face Mecca. Because Islam actually means surrender. It's submissiveness. So this is this submissiveness, that you are great, nomidya. I bow down to you, O worshipable one. Idya means O worshipable one. Nomidya te, I bow down to you, O worshipable one. Why am I worshipping you? Because you have unlimited power. Now, how can we conceive of what unlimited power is with an intelligence that only can conceive the limited? We don't have any experience of the infinite. We don't have a concept in our consciousness, in our mind, of the unlimited. But Brahma, for Brahma, who is actually a devotee and who is wondering what Krishna was going to do as a reaction to what he had done in taking away the calves and the boys. He wanted to know if Krishna was going to do something wonderful or what. Or Brahma was thinking, perhaps he'll just understand that he, unless I'm kind to him, he's not going to get his cows, calves and boys back, and he's going to pray to me and ask me for them. He didn't know, he didn't have a concept to deal with this little cowherd boy. But then, when Krishna displayed his expansions before him, and Brahma got a glimpse. And why do I say a glimpse of Krishna's power? Not that he understood Krishna's power. Because if unlimited came from him, if twice as many came from him and he didn't get less, how many unlimited could come from him before he began to be depleted? Unlimited. This is what achintya shakti means in Sanskrit. It means there's no meaning to the Supreme Absolute Truth unless one accepts the concept of inconceivably powerful. So Brahma got a glimpse that I cannot see the shore of the ocean of his power. I can just see that it is vast and beyond my comprehension. And therefore, see, when one, say if, who is the most powerful person in this world right now, say? I mean, just, okay, make you just a very powerful person. Who would you say? Who is it for you? Okay.
Obama.
So if Obama walked in, now, because he's powerful, what would we do immediately?
Stand up.
Yes, I think we would all naturally just stand up because it's a gesture of respect. But would we be joking in front of him and laughing and no, there would be reverence. Reverence means fear. Not that he was going to send in the United States Marines or anything like that. I mean, what would we really have to be afraid of? But yet, when one comes in contact with power, fear naturally comes to the consciousness, fear and respect. So Brahma, when confronted with the power of Krishna, which was inconceivably great to him, he could not envision its greatness. He did what anyone would do in one sense, or any pious person would do. He said, I offer my respects to you, O worshipable one. And he continues, Namidyate abra vapushe tadit ambraya. This means that I'm looking at you standing here, and remember the contrast between the power that he saw exhibited and this figure standing right before him, this four-year-old boy. And he's describing what he saw, which makes it even more inconceivable the power that this boy had, who's abra vapushe. Vapushe means his body is abra, the color of a monsoon cloud, very, very darkish in color, darkish, blackish, bluish, but very, very effulgent. Once in Vrindavan, and one morning when I was in Vrindavan during the rainy season, and I can only remember it happening on this level once, the sun was rising and there were clouds in the sky, these bluish monsoon clouds, and the effulgence of the sun was shining through these dark rain-filled clouds, and it was wonderful. It was wonderful. So Abra Vapushe, Tadit. Tadit means lightning, Ambaraya, whose complexion is like an effulgent monsoon cloud, darkish, but simultaneously bright. And his dhoti, his cloth, was like lightning, effulgent, yellow. Because lightning is it's high voltage. Effulgently yellow, tadit ambarai. So he's looking and describing who he is paying obeisances to. And then gunja avatangse, and he's wearing earrings of this special type of berries that one sees really only in Vrindavan. I've never seen them anywhere else. They are called gunja mala. Does anyone have any gunja mala in their gunja berries in their pocket by chance? Yeah, no? No. Because they're little, they're reddish and blackish, and they come in like beans, and they grow on a vine, and then around Kartik time in October in Vrindavan, then they ripen and they fall to the ground, and they're little red blackish berries about this big. And Krishna's friends, they string them together and make garlands of these reddish blackish berries. And here Krishna was wearing earrings of these berries. Now he's so if he was 14 years old, we would say he's a cool teenager. But since he's only 4 years old, we can only say that he's already a master of fancy dressing. I mean, he's wearing effulgent clothes and earrings of these gunja berries, reddish and blackish gunja berries. And on top of his head, paripicha is a peacock feather. Multicolored peacock feather, and Krishna is very fond of the peacocks of Vrindavan and their offerings to him of their peacock feathers. So as the boys and Krishna go out into the forest, even though their mothers dress them in jewels and finery, but the boys and Krishna prefers the ornaments that are available from the Vrindavan forest. So when Krishna, this is a bit when he's older, when he dances, when Krishna dances, sometimes he imitates the peacocks dancing. And the cowherd boys say, oh, these peacocks, they can't dance properly. Does anyone ever seen a peacock dance? Yeah? Yeah? What did it look like to you?
Full of energy.
Yes. I won't ask you to demonstrate, but yeah, like that. And then their necks out, and Krishna would imitate the way they put their necks out as they dance. Yeah, that's quite good, actually. And they shake their feathers, and they shake it, and it sounds like the wind going through a banyan tree. One thing it sounds like, with the leaves shaking against each other. It's this shaking. Sometimes I would think it sounds like a cobra, but it's really incredible. They just shake and shake, and how do you do that again? With the arms? Yeah, yes, that's really good. So when the peacocks so much appreciate Krishna's playing his flute that they start dancing, and out of appreciation, they, just like if they, in Australia, they have people, they call it busking. I never heard that term before I went to Australia. It means they, there's people playing musical instruments out on the street, and they open up their guitar box or something like that, and people come by and they make their offering.
It's called busking in England as well.
Yeah. In China, it's called illegal. But so the peacocks, when Krishna plays his flute, they drop their feathers. This is how the residents of Vrindavan see it, as an offering to Krishna. And Krishna, appreciating the offering, he takes the feather and puts it, like you touch it to your head, and then he puts it in his hair or his top knot or something like that. So Paripiksha lasan mukhaya, his face, mukhaya, his face is effulgent, beautiful and effulgent. And Vanya Sri Jay, that he's wearing around his neck, a garland of forest flowers, and all the boys, they would always go to the forest of Vrindavan and pick one flower and pick, and the kind of flowers that garlands Krishna would wear would be down to his knees, very, very long, that would, when he's walking, they would sway back and forth. So what a beautiful, beautiful scene. And Brahma's watching this little boy with his peacock feather atop his head. And then Vanya Srije Kavala Vetra Vashana Venu. And what other things does he have that are really unique to Krishna in the forest of Vrindavan? He has his kavala, he has that food in his left hand. Kavala Vetra Vashana Venu. He's got a stick in the left side over here, along with a buffalo horn, Vashana. And then on the right side, in his waist belt, he has his Venu, his flute, which is approximately, the Venu is about 6 inches inside, which is, what's that in millimeters or centimeters?
17.
Okay, approximately 17 centimeters in size is Krishna's Venu flute. And he's got it, and it makes a very, very high, sweet sound. And Krishna has that here, and Krishna's just standing there, Lakshma Sriye. And he's characterized by these things, and also Mridupade, Pashupangajaya. Mridupade means he has very, very soft feet. And he's wandering through the Vrindavan forest, making the forest, this will be described later actually, making the forest fortunate by the touch of his lotus feet. At this time, Krishna's feet are considered very, 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 very soft because he's only 4 years old. And later on, when he's a bit older in the Poganda age, at the age of 6, when he walks through the Vrindavan forest, the markings on the bottom of his feet, because his feet are stronger and somewhat harder, they are, and he's more developed. And he marks the forest of Vrindavan more clearly with the signs of his lotus feet. But here, just the lotus feet. They're very, 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 very soft. So, because they're so soft, Mother Yashoda was very hesitant to allow him to go out into the forest. Because what would happen if he stepped on a pebble or a thorn or... when ankur means sprout, when there's a sprout from a seed of some plant in the forest, it can be very sharp. and it could injure the footing, because Krishna's just a little boy. And Brahma is watching him, but he knows that he is unlimitedly powerful. Vedanti tat tat farvedas tat famyas brahma. Gyanam adhyam brahmeti paramaneti baloneti sabhita. He is the absolute truth in the form of Bhagavan, or even more than just Bhagavan. He's Krishna, the supreme absolute truth. He's more than even Narayan and Vishnu. He is Pashupangajaya. He is the son of he who protects the animals, which is Nanda Maharaj. So here is the translation. Lord Brahma said, "My dear Lord, you are the only worshipable Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And therefore, I offer my humble obeisances and prayers just to please you." So that's the purpose of the obeisances. Perhaps we can open up our windows. The obeisances are meant to respect and to please the Supreme Lord. It's an offering, because we have, as will be described later by Brahma, we have our body, we have our possessions, we have our words, we have our minds, and all of these are supposed to be offered to Krishna with great devotion, with the purpose of pleasing him. And the purpose of pleasing him for Lord Brahma was a hope that he would attain Krishna, because he had watched the pastime, the activities of Krishna dealing with the other residents of Vrindavan. And very soon he's going to say, "I thought you were a little boy," not in these words, "but now, with limited power, but now I understand that you have unlimited power. I don't understand your unlimited power, but I know that your power is unlimited. What is the meaning of the Supreme Lord or God or the Ishwara or whatever name one ascribes? What is the meaning of that if his power, if we can understand the limit of his power? He is not God. Because our abilities to understand are finite." So Brahma, understanding that a different methodology is required than he had previously used, which we could say is two methodologies. One is using his intelligence to try to understand the potency of this boy, and the second was to test, to understand his power. And now he's understood that a whole different process is required to understand him. And that process is called devotional service, and beginning with surrender. Because then if the Supreme Lord is pleased, then he lets himself be known by his causeless mercy to the bhakta, to the devotee. He lets himself be known when our love is to the devotee, when our love is unflinchingly pure and in a mood that's harmonious with his mood. Then he allows that devotee to know his confidential side that is unavailable, unaccessible to ordinary people or even ordinary devotees or ordinary worshippers, let's say. So he's offering his prayers and submitting, making his attempt at bhakti so that Krishna will give him his mercy. So there's two factors in this. There is one's own attempt and then Krishna's reciprocation with that attempt. So our attempt is the acts of devotional service, which have two sides to them. Bhava Rupa and Chaste Rupa. This is especially mentioned in relationship to very high devotional service, but the external activity and then the mood of the activity. So we have to learn how to perform the activity properly, but we also have to learn gradually or quickly to have the proper mood when we're performing devotional service or making a devoted offering to Krishna. We want to do it properly in such a way that he'll be pleased and in the proper mood. And the proper mood is a devotional offering. And of course there are many moods according to one's position in devotional service, but it's basically, may you be pleased by this. Let me do this in such a way that you will be pleased. I am not the center. You are the center. And this immediately means the removal of false ego and being established in real ego, who we actually are, because who we actually are, we are Krishnas. We are Krishnas. Brahma continues, my dear Lord, neither I nor anyone else can estimate the potency of this transcendental body of yours, which has shown such mercy to me. What mercy did Krishna show Brahma? He allowed Brahma to see him. He was actually seeing Brahma. Brahma was actually seeing Krishna in this amazing form. He had seen the Vasudeva or Vishnu forms, the forms of Krishna. But now he was seeing the most wonderful of all forms, this little, inconceivably beautiful, inconceivably powerful boy. So you have, neither I nor anyone else can estimate the potency of this transcendental body of yours. And he had just experienced that, which has shown such mercy to me, and which appears just to fulfill the desires of your pure devotees. So he's here saying why this inconceivably powerful person comes to this world, because we come, all of us are in this world, so we've come here, but none of us have exactly chosen to come and be born in a particular body, in a particular state, in a particular country, with a particular mentality. We're just sort of forced into this, and then suddenly there we are. But when we're talking about the all-powerful Supreme Lord, what would cause him to be in this world? So he describes it here is to fulfill the desires of your pure devotees who are in this world, and they want to see you. And you come just out of your affection for your pure devotees. So this hints immediately at what Brahma's, some of the greatest aspects of his realization, that this all-powerful Lord, he is not a hardened dictator sitting on his throne, but rather he is always reciprocating and wanting to please and acting to please his devotees in reciprocation for their love for him. In reciprocation for their love for him, he like any other, it is just natural that when we understand the love that we've been given by someone, the affectionate gifts this person has given us, then naturally only everyone but the hardest person, hardest-hearted person, will feel gratitude, and then how can I reciprocate? That's why all the devotees have so much respect and affection for Prabhupada, although most of them, the devotees nowadays, no one has even met him physically. But when one hears the story of his, of what he did at 70 years old, you know, beginning the Hare Krishna movement, you read how one of the real striking ones is when, have you read the whole Prabhupada Lilamrita where he goes to San Francisco and he's dealing with these essentially crazy people, and he's coming from this most cultured background, aristocratic cultured background in Calcutta, which has its own standards, its own ways of dealing, and there he is to give the gift of Krishna consciousness to the West. He's penniless and dealing with these, and people are banging on his door in the middle of the night, and screaming, because they've taken intoxicants, and they're screaming. Yes, the Prabhupada opens the door. Yes, what do you want? Ooh la la, ooh, making crazy, insane sounds. And he's over 73 years old or something, and he's just dealing with this because he's driven by this desire out of compassion. And then he's traveling all over the world and managing and running the society, and because no one knew it, and managing the building of the Jew temple and fighting with these people who are trying to cheat him. And India at that time was... has anyone ever been to India in the 70s or something like that? Maybe some of you were born there and alive there and old men and ladies there at that time, but it was very, very austere. And he was like, to get something done there was incredible. And there he was, like, struggling away, doing that, and then traveling here and struggling there, and getting a temple and, dealing with George Harrison. And you hear these stories. Like, you ever hear that one that Mukunda Maharaj tells, how he went, that he and Shyamasundar Prabhu, when Prabhupada asked him, Shyamasundar, to ask George Harrison to pay for the Krishna book. When you're dealing with, wealthy, famous people, and you're just establishing your relationship with them, everyone's always asking them for things and trying to squeeze something out of them. So the last thing that Shyamasundar, who likes him and has a relationship with him, wants to ask him for anything, but Prabhupada asks him to ask George Harrison for the money to print Krishna book. So they're sitting there, and I don't remember how it went, but George Harrison, they're sitting there in George Harrison's house, and Shyamasundar's thinking, well, I'm going to have to do it. Prabhupada told me to do it. Mm-hmm. And then he's sort of, and finally he says that, Prabhupada has asked me to ask you if you could pay for the printing of this book about Krishna. And George Harrison says, it's not that I have all this, and suddenly, out of nowhere, the lights go off. The lights go off in the house, in his mansion. And then after a while, they go on again. And he said, well, I guess I will give the money, I mean, there's unlimited things. So everyone loves him, even though no one's met him, when you hear about his activities and things. Because Krishna just... And there's this other one that I was thinking of. just now. I met the man several times. His name is Mr. Sethi in Bombay. He was born in Pakistan, but during the partition of India, he came across very, but he arrived in Bombay with nothing. So gradually he worked, and he had some houses, and he was in the construction business. And then at one point he really hurt his back. And his doctor told him, well, hurt something in his back. And his doctor told him that you have to go to England immediately and have operation, otherwise you're not going to survive. So, and he did some very amazing service for Prabhupada. Really incredible service. Well, there was no one else really helping him at that time except for the Western devotees who didn't really know anything. This person was established in society and sort of very, very big physically and in his position. And Prabhupada, so he said, I have to go to England. And Prabhupada said, no, you don't. And then he explained what the doctor said. And he said, you don't have to go, you can walk. I mean, I don't like usually to tell miracle stories about Prabhupada, but in a few hours he was walking. And then Prabhupada later said, he prayed to Krishna. He said, I've said this now, Krishna, you have to fulfill my words. And he was walking. And then there's videos of Mr. Sethi talking about Prabhupada. And he said, the first time I met him, and he's a very big, I guess he's Punjabi, very big, with those mustaches, strong. And he said, everyone is always afraid of me. There's a loud voice. And then I saw Prabhupada, and he wasn't very, very big. And he asked me what I do. How is your day? He said, I get up in the morning, I do this, I go to work, and then I come work all day long, and come back and eat, and then go to sleep. And Prabhupada, he said, and then he said that Prabhupada said to him, what is the difference between you and a pig? And he said, I was very surprised because everyone's always afraid of me. He could do things like that. He could speak very boldly, but because there was no enmity in his heart, and then sometimes he would say something very, very radical like that, and then smile in this way that just would charm everyone. One time in somewhere, he was traveling in the United States, and there was one young lady reporter. And she was wearing a very short skirt. So she asked Prabhupada, why do you have a shaved head? You know, they often ask, you know, why, what's the meaning of this? You know, not the deepest questions. She said, why do you have a shaved head? And he replied, because he was so sharp, he said, why do you have a short skirt? It's better to have a cool head and warm legs. What could she say? And then he would just like smile. One time in Australia in 1975, he came and to the Melbourne airport, and he had a there was a press conference. He was sitting on the VIP lounge, and had a press conference. And the reporter asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami." And she said, what does the AC stand for? And he said, you won't understand. Please tell me what the AC stands for. You won't understand. Please tell me what the AC stands for. And then it says, what it stands for is Abhayacharanaravindam, which means fearless by the lotus feet in Sanskrit and Bengali. But then he said, Abhayacharanaravindam, so fast that I couldn't even understand it. So she said, what did you say? And Prabhupada said, I told you, you wouldn't understand. He was just very clever. Too. And then he would just smile. So, why does Krishna come? Brahma says, you appear in this world just to fulfill the desires of your pure devotees. And although my mind is completely withdrawn from material affairs, in other words, my mind is not affected and afflicted by the mode of passion or the mode of ignorance, because these modes of nature, when our mind is sped up in passion and or sleepy due to ignorance, we cannot see things clearly and accurately. And we all experience this when we sit down and try to chant japa attentively. We can't have the experience of what we're doing very easily because of the modes of material nature affecting our minds. So Brahma is saying, my mind is completely withdrawn from any material affliction or infection or contamination or involvement. It's withdrawn from the material world, so my mind is completely clear. But yet, I cannot understand your personal form. I'm seeing it before me, but I can't understand it. So how then could I possibly understand the happiness you experience within yourself? You're performing these pastimes. Pastimes, that word is a translation from the Sanskrit word of, what is the Sanskrit word? Lila. Well, that's a good name. You should patent it. Copyright it.
In Hebrew, it's Alila.
It's Alila?
Alila, yeah.
What's Alila?
Last time.
Lila? Oh, really? Who started it? I don't want to get into a religious theological debate. So if you can't, if this person is inconceivable, then why assume that the activities he's performing, even though they resemble the activities that ordinary people perform, why assume that the activities are of the same nature and qualities as those performed by the ordinary people? Or, on the other hand, he's performing these activities with other people. And if he's an inconceivably powerful person, why assume that there are ordinary activities performed with other ordinary people? So he's saying, Brahma has come to understand that I can't understand. I cannot understand you, nor the activities that you're performing. What to speak of the experience of happiness. Your experience of happiness that's coming as a result of your performing these activities, these lilas, these pastimes. Because there's such a tendency, the psychological term is to project, to take our what's going on in our own mind and project it on what everyone else is doing. So we think, Because I'm this kind of a naughty person, So when I see you doing something that if I was doing it, I know what I would be doing. I know what I'd be thinking. I know what I'd be, what would be motivating me. Therefore, this is what you're doing. But actually, we're only seeing our own minds, basically. That's the meaning of that Sanskrit term, Atmavan Manyate Jagat. When we look at the universe, we're basically seeing our own minds. So what does it mean if the universe looks looks back at us and frowns at us? We're just seeing an aspect of our own consciousness. And that's, I've noticed that point very much, that life or the universe is always teaching me. And one of the ways, because we say, oh, who will guide me, who will take care of me, who will instruct me, but the universe is continuously instructing us, continuously by, and the easiest way it instructs us is to see what is really disturbing us about the universe. And it's something generally, not always, something that we have to work on in ourselves, because this is our mind projecting on the universe. Anyway, that's a whole different psychological topic. But Brahma is saying that I'm completely stopping to project my own limited consciousness upon you, your activities, and the happiness that you experience by performing these activities. And why have I stopped that? Because I've just gotten a glimpse of what unlimited power you actually have. And therefore, he's like this. I'm stopping my making believe I understand who you are, what you're thinking, what you're doing, what you're experiencing. I'm stopping because I've understood this is so far beyond me. So does that mean, because he's saying that I can't understand you. So does that mean that that Krishna is ununderstandable? That we can't understand anything about him? And then Brahma answers that question in the next verse, and the answer is no. It doesn't mean that we can't understand him, but it does mean that we can't understand him using our material, finite, limited experience as the basis of understanding the spiritual realm. We can't use our intelligence to penetrate into the spiritual realm. But there is another way to understand him. The ununderstandable can actually be understood. And he's going to now explain how. A very famous verse that Lord Chaitanya very much appreciated, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Gyane praya sam urapasya namanteva jivanti san mukuritam bhavadiyavatam. This means you have to give up something, the usual methodology of understanding in this world. As soon as we talk about understanding something, we immediately are talking about using our intelligence as the means to penetrate into the object to understand it. We use our intelligence and the ability of the intelligence to understand and to see more than just the eyes see and the ears hear, etc. So, gane prayasam, one has to give up this process of, we would call it ascending knowledge, using our own intellectual abilities to understand the absolute truth. Because remember, Brahma has concluded that your power is so great, it's so far beyond anything that I can even conceive of, that all I can do is offer my obeisances and worship you. So Gyane Prayasam Urupasta Namante Eva, I give up this process, ascending process, trying to build my understanding to the point of understanding your power. And Namante Eva, instead, I offer my obeisances. So into the realm of bhakti. I offer my obeisances to what? Jivanti san mukuritam bhavadiya vartam. To the pastimes about you, the Krishna Katha, the Bhagavad Gita, the messages that you have spoken in Bhagavad Gita, and the messages spoken about you in the Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita. And Stinestitam Shutagatam Tanoman Manobir. I just hear these messages. I hear about you from authorized sources that have a clear and accurate understanding of who you are. Stenestitam means I don't have to change everything externally or anything externally. Stenestitam means I stay in your place. Wherever you are, you stay in that situation and just take up this process of hearing. Stenestita Shutagatam. You stay in your place and you let everything about you, O Lord, will be revealed by this process of hearing about you. So it's a completely different system than that is the system of gaining knowledge in the material world. In the material world, one, of course, when one's in the first grade, in the second grade, in the third grade, fourth grade, we listen to our teachers, they say, make an A or an Aleph. I forgot how to make an Aleph. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. And you just do what they say. But then, when you're actually mature, you don't have to listen to anyone anymore. This is the ascending process of knowledge. And in fact, the better that you don't accept what anyone has said, because we have to evolve past what they have said to more truth, to closer truth. More, we have to go beyond. So nothing should be accepted. Nothing should be accepted, rather, one has to experiment and learn better and more accurate truths. So it's an ascending process. You build upon the partial truths of the past to go higher and higher and get closer and closer, disagree with everyone, and you will, I think it was Sir Isaac Newton who said, if I have seen further than anyone else, it's because if I have stood on the heads of giants. That's not our process, standing on the heads of our previous teachers. He was trying to compliment them, but to stand on their heads is not very respectful. Maybe he said shoulders. Still not very respectful. But our process that Brahma is describing is you hear, rather than trying to find it by your own power, going closer to it, but you hear about it from those who know the truth. Tat vidhi paripavsena sevaya. You hear about it and they reveal to you. How otherwise are we going to understand something about Krishna? That the Supreme Absolute Truth, the Supreme Lord, is likes gunza earrings, gunza berry earrings, and he likes to play the flute. And he wears a peacock feather at his hand. And thus, hearing from someone who is accurately in relationship to the Supreme Truth, how will we know that? Like the us, say if you buy some wheat in the store, you buy a big bag of wheat flour. So how you can understand something about how this wheat flour came to you with your own intelligence? You can say, you can look on the pack, and it will, maybe the package, and will say it is grown in where is wheat grown here that comes?
Italy.
Yeah, Italy, isn't it? The wheat comes from the United States?
No.
Comes from everywhere. Not all. Huh? Yes?
Kibbutz also.
Oh, okay. But okay, so if you read the pack, and just by reading direct perception, you can understand that there's some farmer somewhere, maybe you can understand the country it was imported from. So you can understand perhaps there's some farmer somewhere got on his tractor and grew the weed and then harvested it and then sold it to some company who ground up the weed. And so you can understand something about it. But can you understand what that farmer's life is like? Through your speculative methods, through your ascending jnana type of methods, can you understand what the farmer's life is like, what his wife is like, what his children are like, what happinesses he goes through, what miseries and difficulties he's going through, what kind of tractor he has, what else does he grow on his land, what he looks like, does he have a mustache, does he wear a hat, is he strong, is he healthy, is he weak, is he ill, and his family and his grandparents, are they alive, and what do they look like? And you can't understand these things, these details about the person, with your intelligence by looking at the wheat. So looking at the material world and trying to use our intelligence to understand the creator and of the material world and who he is and what he does, it's not possible to understand his personality and his characteristics and his life. It's just not possible. But that doesn't mean that it's that you can't know them, but you just have to use a different method. You have to if you can find someone's, I know where that wheat came from. I know because I have a connection to this company. I know that farm, and I know that farm, and I know what his life is like. And I will tell you what it's like. And then just by the process of hearing, you will also know. So that's the basic system that Brahma is saying. To stay in your place, don't make big external changes, because there's such a tendency to want to do that, make a big external change, as if the big external change is going to make a deep internal change. So sometimes external changes are certainly necessary, but the internal change is really what what one is looking for. And the internal change that Brahma is speaking about here is knowing about Krishna and turning towards him and developing a relationship, your loving relationship with him. And ultimately what he's going to say is the result of this hearing process is just staying in your place, shutigatam tanuvan manobhya, and paying your respects to the Krishna Gita with hearing about Krishna from devotees, with your words, with your mind, and with your body. And our acharyas explain different ways. With our bodies, we respect the messages by just sitting there and listening. And even they say, we fold our hands when we when we listen. It means it's a sign of respecting them, and and keeping one's body in control. And to keep one's body in control means you have to keep your mind in control. So that brings one to the mental level of respecting by hearing attentively and faithfully. And with one's words, glorifying the process, the topics, and repeating them. Did you hear this? Did you hear this? Did you hear this? What did you think about that? Listening, hearing, discussing. So in these different ways, and there's more ways than I just mentioned, but these are the ways to offer respects. Namante eva san mukritam bhavadiya vartam stanesthita shrutagatam tanuvan, with one's words, with one's mind and one's body. And then by this process, Brahma says, by this process of hearing, not by challenging or trying to force one's way through one's great intelligence, I will understand the absolute truth with my intelligence. I will understand everything. I will defeat the undefeatable with my intelligence. But rather than that, the last line says, Ye prayaso, jito jito pyasitas trilokya. He who is unconquerable, ajita, unconquerable within the three worlds, the upper, middle, and lower planetary system, becomes conquered by the simple process of hearing about him. So Brahma says that. Here is the translation. Those who, even while remaining situated in their established social positions, throw away the process of speculative knowledge. That's how Prabhupada referred to making the attempt to understand the something with one's intelligence. Speculative knowledge means it's always unsure. Your knowledge, one's knowledge and intelligence is limited by the intellectual platform. And what one realizes isn't truth, but rather it's playing around on this intellectual, subtle mental intellectual platform, which different kinds of people, some kinds of people are very addicted to that kind of pleasure. There are people who are really addicted to the physical pleasures of this body, and that's their whole life. And then there are people who are addicted to the level of experiencing pleasure is on the intellectual platform, and they love that platform, and they love to fly and soar around on that platform, and it's a more subtle level of enjoyment, and then there are people who see the limitations of both those platforms, but prefer the spiritual platform, the platform of that has a special, a different flavor. It's of a different quality. Each of these have different flavors and qualities. So that's on one level. That's really what we're trying to do by the process of hearing about Krishna and chanting, is develop a more refined taste. There are people who have unrefined taste who like to go to fast food places, and they sit down and they and they're fully satisfied and fully happy and fully unhealthy perhaps, but you know, that's their tongue is, this is great. And then there's gourmet type of people who have very refined tongues and sense of taste, and they can't even eat that kind of food, they can't even smell that kind of food, and it's, oh. Different kinds of cultivated tastes. So refinement. So one could say, well, contemporary people say, well, you like this, I like that, it's the same. But it isn't the same. One is more refined, and the more refined taste gives one a more subtle and refined and more pleasure. If you have a taste for fine art, very, very subtle and taste for fine art, you can see that you're harder to please because your taste is more refined, but you can see on a more subtle level, and it gives more pleasure. That type of training is required to have that kind of taste, and a cultivation is required. So similarly, to develop one's spiritual taste, to refine one's sense of pleasure to the spiritual platform, to the holy names, to the kirtan, to japa, to shastra, to the holy places. Like some people, they'll go to a holy place like Vrindavan, and they'll only see plastic bags and chaos and horns continuously going. And that's there. It's not that that's not there, but it's not all that's there. There's so much more that's actually going on there. And that so much more is so captivating. But it takes a certain amount of cultivation. And the kirtan, when I remember, I'm thinking right now in Melbourne, that when the devotees would go on Harinam Sankirtan, and still do. Last year when I was there was some big festival, and devotees from all over Australia came, and there were about 150 devotees going down the main streets of Melbourne, and it was very powerful because there were so many devotees and different people. You could see how different people reacted completely differently. People who had never come in contact with Krishna consciousness. Some were really angry to see it. And first I thought, is this the right thing we should be doing? But then I watched, because there were people who were like that, but then I watched the vast majority of people were actually thought, this is really wonderful. And then there were some people who were a little bit shy maybe, but they came forward and they wanted to dance with the devotees. So different people, according to their taste, according to their piety, they react different to a spiritual experience. And though when you distribute prasadam, you probably see that a lot. I mean, the people just see that this is extraordinary. You know, it's just something very, very, very different. And what more and more? Who was telling me? Oh, Daria, what was it on? Was it Saturday or Sunday?
Friday.
What was it? It was the kids, children.
Yeah, the kids really appreciate them. They like the prasad very much.
Did they say? Were they?
They love everything.
Huh?
They love everything.
And they took a lot. And I remember the first time I took prasadam in the University of Buffalo in 1968. And I remember after taking this food that Rupa Nukupu had cooked and then offered to on his little altar, from then on I was always thinking, when could I eat that food again? I was hungry from then on. The people that you distribute the cakes to, the workers, there's something about it. It's a different taste, a higher taste. So it takes a cultivation, but certain things like prasadam and kirtan, they can easily pierce. So Brahma says again, that don't make an external change if you want to understand. But rather, stay in your position. Throw away the process of speculative knowledge. And offer all respects with the body, mind, and words to descriptions of your narrations, which are vibrated by you personally and by your pure devotees. Those persons certainly conquer your lordship, although you are otherwise unconquerable by anyone within the three worlds. So Krishna willing, tomorrow we'll continue with some more of this. His instructions, I find Brahma's instructions are really nice and really practical and also very important. Okay, any questions or comments? Thank you. Was that a question? No.
No. Quickly appreciation.
Huh? Okay. Oh, with folded hands. Okay, then that's. Yes?
That point that you mentioned about the farmer, that we can't understand him by just reading the ingredients on the.
Or by, even if you read them and then use your great power of intelligence to understand, you'll never understand about the personality of Godhead, personality of the form.
So how does it apply to our endeavor intellectually to understand the universe or the world?
Yeah, you'll specifically speaking about Krishna here, but in general you can understand something about the universe or the world, but you'll never actually understand it fully unless you understand Krishna's relationship with it, the Creator's relationship with it. That's described in the 11th canto. You'll never be able to do it because you, the observer, affects what's being observed. You cannot separate the you, your mind, and the sense objects. You can't get an objective view of the universe is not possible. But you can understand it, that this is, and instead of, the conclusion is, instead of trying to find this objective, what is the world really composed of? What is the actual essence of a clip, and what is it really made out of when it's at the finest point? You'll never be able to understand. But if you, instead of doing that, you see that this is made out of metal. The metal is coming from the earth, and we take the ingredients, and some factory in China buys the metal from Australia, the aluminum from Australia, and then boing, and this comes out, and these ingredients, they all come from Krishna. So therefore, because it comes from Krishna, and you can't, I heard Prabhupada speak about this morning, that if you give a carpenter the ingredients to build some shelves, and then the carpenter says, "I built the shelves, they're mine." No. That's not right. You supplied him the materials. He didn't build them. He didn't create it. So the person who supplies the materials and we could say pays the wages of the carpenter, that's who things belong to. And they should, and it should be used for him. So in the same way, the supplier of all ingredients is Krishna. No one can make anything. There's one little story of one man who came to see Prabhupada in Bombay, and someone said, "What do you do, sir?" He was a big industrialist. He said, "I make glass." So Prabhupada, of course, said, "You make glass. Where do you get the ingredients from?" And he said, this sand. "Did you make the sand?" "Who made the sand?" So then Prabhupada was poking him in this way. And then Prabhupada said, "What do we call someone who takes the ingredients from Krishna but keeps everything for himself after he uses them?" And the devotee, of course, said, "We call such a person a thief, Prabhupada." And then the man said, no, I also give donations. And Prabhupada said, oh, you're an honest thief. And then he smiled and everyone laughed. And the man laughed. Oh, you're an honest thief. So what was your question again? What did you ask about the...
You answered it.
Oh, okay. Yes.
There is a... you said about yogis, and they are kind of absorb themselves in some kinds of items, say the clip, and then become one with it, and then they're supposed to know it. So how can we develop this?
This is actually something like what you said is described in at the very end of the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, at the end of the Uddhava Gita, where it talks about developing yogic siddhis, powers, how to do that, perfections. And if I remember correctly, you have to absorb yourself in the aspect of Krishna's energy that clip came from. And that, not that you become one with the clip, but you get, according to what type of energy you've absorbed yourself in, you get a kind of mystic perfection. So if you absorb yourself in the air energy, it's right there in the 11th canto. Then by the meditation on that aspect of Krishna's energy, knowing it comes from Krishna, then you get a particular type of mystic perfection, such as being able to, with the air, you know, just float in the sky or something, or an atom or something, make yourself small and the smallest. But, it says, the transcendentalist yogis, they don't want these perfections. Rather than thinking of them as desirable things, they see them as impediments towards on the spiritual path. So that's actually the conclusion of that section. Because it's so easy for a conditioned soul who's longing to become powerful and to become the center and the one to take that same desire with him on the spiritual path and get waylaid from his spiritual pursuit by a longing for power. Bhakti mukti siddhi kami sakari asanta. Such a tendency, even on the devotional path, to want to become powerful. But actual devotees who are most powerful, they just want to glorify Krishna, and any gifts that they have by Krishna, they never think they're mine. They know they're gifts. Leo, what is it called when you there's an exercise, I can't think of what it's called now. When you sit, no, what is it? Something like that.
Squats.
Yeah, can you do a half squat right now?
Really?
Yeah. That's, yeah. A little further. I just want to get it so Krishna's head or feet are on your head. Okay, now move back. Now move back against the wall. Okay, just stay there. Any other questions? Yeah. Okay, last question, and we'll have a little kirtan.
Can we say that what's happened to Brahma?
Oh, excuse me.
Can we say that what's happened to Brahma?
What happened to Brahma?
That he disrespect Krishna, or
yeah.
And then Krishna will wear him.
And he what?
Krishna grew withering.
Yeah.
And then Krishna became humble.
Then Brahma came, became humble.
Then Krishna revealed himself, gave him his mercy.
But he gave him his mercy right in the beginning by playing with him a little bit and then showing him his so many aspects of his potency and then withdrawing him. And Brahma says, the greatest mercy is you showed me your form, your personal form. Yes, that was the question.
Can you say that something similar to that happened to us, to a person who practicing, he makes speculation, listen to his mind, and don't follow exactly the, what is guru, sadhu, sastra say, he's believed to his mind, makes speculation, and then Krishna bewilder him through his maya, and then become humble, and take shelter of devotee, and then Krishna gave himself even more, even though it was his own mistake, and then Krishna become
For a devotee, or even a devotee of a devotee, or an aspiring devotee, if he's on the path, then definitely Krishna adjusts him, and part of that adjustment is he makes him humble. And if the devotee can see that this is Krishna's kindness, that he's made me understand something, then he's very fortunate, even though it can be a very difficult situation. Did I just agree with you?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yes, Prabhu. What do you think?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Ananta Koti Vaishnavindi Ki Jai, Kantanda Charita Siddhupada Ki Jai, Premsi Kosi Krishna Chaitanya Pramanityananda, Sriya Doita Garadha Sarigoa Vakanandi Ki Jai, Sri Sri Radhakrishna Bhagavana Shamakunda Radhakunda Giri Govardhanandi Ki Jai, Sri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai, Sri Navatipa Maya Purnam Ki Jai, Ganga Mayi Ki Jai, Jamuna Mayi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulasi Devi Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhakti Vindi Ki Jai. All glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees, all glories to Sri Sri Guru Gauranga Nittai, Gaur Pranandai Hari Hari Bhakti. Namaste.